Myth, very important information. Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thanks, Davis.
All right, bye-bye now.
Citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KABU is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KABU Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian. Wednesday, March 4th, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Malcolm X, playing at the Clinton Street Theater February 21st and the 22nd at 7 p.m. Starring Denzel Washington, this biographical film about Malcolm X by Spike Lee will be playing to honor the 50th anniversary of Malcolm X assassination. That's the film, Malcolm X, playing at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, on Saturday, February 21st, and Sunday, February 22nd at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm, on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11:01 a.m. Coming up at 11:30, we hear the organizers of next week's panel discussion on occupation, environmental destruction, and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But right now, host Paul Rowland speaks with author and activist Jerry Mander about corporations, capitalism, and the movement for a new economy. Take it away.
I am on the phone with Jerry Mander. Are you in San Francisco?
I am, yes.
We are going to talk, as I did earlier, with Helena Norberg Hodge about the your upcoming appearance here in Portland at the Economics of Happiness Conference. You wrote a book many years ago called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, which I don't know how many people who are listening or how many younger listeners have read, but it had a really major influence on me, just because it talked about, you know, this interface between the human being and technology in general, but one specific technology. And I was just really struck by the way you really got at the physiological mechanism of television and how that affects our perception and our relationship to the world. And I think that sort of has informed a lot of your work ever since. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah. Well, you know, I had spent quite a few years in the advertising business before that. I was the president of quite a successful ad agency in the 1960s. Before that, I had been a public relations executive. So I had some knowledge of the way it's possible to speak through media into people's brains, you might say. And it was particularly something I really learned in advertising more than anywhere else, because advertising is mostly a process of speaking imagery over and over and over and over and over and over and directing it directly into people's brains. And what people don't realize, and of course the average person is taking that in the 60s and in the 70s and still now, on an average of 4 hours per day is watching television. People think computers have changed all that. All they've done is add to the time we're locked into machines. But people were sitting watching television for 4 hours per day. They still are, and they were getting hit with about 25,000 commercials per month. And all these commercials are speaking images directly into the brain. And everybody thinks, oh, well, these images are silly and stupid and there's no effect on us. But that's completely wrong. My partner in the advertising business, a great genius named Howard Gossage, used to say the dirty little secret of advertising is that the images go in and they never come out. So that if you talk about the Geico lizard or whatever that thing is, or the Jolly Green Giant, or any of the very popular characters from television. I speak to audiences a lot, and I start bringing up some of these things that are on television. I ask people, did that image pop in their head when I said it? And of course, they all say yes. And I say, okay, now erase it from your brain. You know, people can't. But over decades of time, speaking commercial imagery and creating images of how the world is supposed to be and how you're supposed to look and how you're supposed to dress and what's good and what's bad and what's right and what's wrong creates the society, in my view, or has a lot of power in creating the society. Let's not say creates it entirely. And we've had, since the 1960s, when it got really, really, really big, it's been a half a century of images pouring in at a fantastic rate and occupying the... It's one of the tenets of capitalism is you have to occupy the mind, occupy the brain of the global, occupy consciousness is a better way to put it, of the global population as much as you can, or the domestic population, and get people to try to be like the images they see. And that's been a very successful process. And one more point on all that is that people don't realize the degree to which mass media is concentrated in the hands of very few corporations. Globally speaking, 7 corporations own about 73% of global media. That's all media, not including this radio station, I believe. But
indeed not.
But television, computers, billboards, print media, most radio are concentrated in the hands of 7 corporations. They have sub-corporations, so it looks like there's a lot of different corporations. But when you go back into the stock market, you find out that there are 7 corporations that own 70%+ of global media. And so what you have is a great example of the way capitalism drives to control the instruments of consciousness and then also the instruments of government, of course, as we see now, the degree of corporate control of global, of national political processes, et cetera. And it's all in the interest of growth, expansion, more production, more commodity production. And in the end, you get a dead planet and a kind of population that has a hard time getting true information and knowing up from down.
So, you know, it seems like just the sheer immensity of what's coming down at us, that's really beginning to sink in to still a small minority, I guess, of people on the planet, because it's really difficult to even attempt to get a sense of what the global implications ecologically, socially are of what this system has done to us. It seems to me we're caught in this. You know, we're caught between, like someone once said, between a world that is dying and a world that is still being born.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, you know. But we have to keep on trucking, because you know, the reason I wrote this book on capitalism is that one thing I noticed in our movement, and I'll include you in that, toward a new economy and a new appreciation of what needs to happen, is that people will speak about new economy in very vague terms a lot of the time. And a couple of years ago, and I wrote about this in the book, the reason I wrote the book is that a couple of years ago, the International Forum on Globalization, which I'm a part of, had a conference among 35 very, 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 very outstanding economists from the right to the left. It was very, very broad. And where we tried to speak, this was in 2008, and where we tried to predict the disastrous direction of things, and that the nature was collapsing, and inequities were growing, and how the whole thing was just not working out at all for individuals, and again in Helena's terms, for the general happiness and well-being. And about 2 days into this conference, we decided to create a statement saying, you know, we have to start speaking of what's been up until now the third rail of discourse. You can talk about new system, but you can't say anything about capitalism, generally speaking. Very, very rarely do people name capitalism as the structure of capitalism, the ingredients of capitalism, and why it's creating a system which is invariably going to lead to the kind of things that are happening now. You know, and so we were going to name capitalism, and we decided to put out a statement to that sense. And then two of the economists, and these are very smart guys, very progressive guys, whom I won't say their names. You probably know who they are. You've probably been on the air with them. They stood up and they said, no, sorry, listen, if you guys are going to do a statement against capitalism, we have to leave the room. We can't sign, and you can't say that we were here at this meeting either. And we said, well, why are you doing that? We know that you agree with this. And they said, well, it'll marginalize us. I said, we're already marginalized, you know? It's like, and so anyway, I decided at that point, I've got to do a book to describe why, what the ingredients of capitalism are that make it impossible for it to support a sustainable society. And it's, and the longer we have it, the worse it's going to get. And we have to start talking about meaningful alternatives. I'm not talking about communism. I'm not talking about socialism. I'm talking about, you know, coming up with a system that responds to the needs of the planet and to the needs of human beings, and that is where fairness and sustainability are the prime driving forces, and where local is what matters rather than global, and a long list of ingredients and so on that are in the book. But the point is that saying capitalism out loud is like a third rail of discourse. You know, you touch it and you're dead, you know? So I decided, okay, I'm old enough now. I'm 78 years old. So what can they do to me now? So I decided kind of like to go ahead. Now Naomi Klein has come up with a great book, and other people have too. And it's great. So at least we can talk about the actual subject and what its ingredients are, and what Helena is concentrating on is what are the alternative structures, and many of us are doing the same thing.
So, you know, the name of the book is The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. Just maybe you could just go through and, you know, just name off what you see as the intrinsic features of capitalism that make it obsolete from the get-go, basically.
I think I almost called the book, you know, Seven Arguments for the Elimination of Capitalism, but I thought that's too close to the TV book, and the publisher is mad at me because I didn't call it that. He thinks that would have been the much more commercial title. In any case, the primary problems are intrinsic need, unchangeable, driving need for growth. The capitalist system has to grow. That's the whole idea. You have to increase your dollars. That's what capitalism is about. It's you invest more in order to make more, in order to make more, in order to make more, and that means more resources, more domination of systems, and so on. And if it causes problems, that's a problem for everybody else. But your goal is to make money, and so it doesn't really matter. So that's, growth is not okay. Constant growth. We've gone way outside of the level of growth, and we need to speak about stabilized, steady state economies and so on. Secondly, it's amoral. It has no value. You know, I love to talk about the movie Avatar. I don't know how many of your listeners saw that movie, but I didn't think it was a great movie, but there was one scene in that movie that really captures the point. And that's when the corporate spaceship guy, who is out on a mission among the planets to find more resources so capitalism can keep growing, and they find a planet out there which has all the resources they need, but it's populated by a whole lot of Indians, indigenous peoples, And so he sends the military guy down to the planet and told them they have to leave and they have to move over to the other side of the planet. And they say, they're not going to leave. And so the military guy calls him up and says, sorry, they don't want to leave. So what should I do? Should I kill them? And then the corporate guy goes into, this is the brilliant moment in the film, goes through a process of what I call corporate schizophrenia, where he tries to value the question of should he kill them or let them be. And he goes through this process where he says, well, our investors won't really like it if we kill them all. But on the other hand, they'll like it less if they get a quarterly, bad quarterly financial statement. So, yeah, go ahead and kill them all. And then they decide to go to war and kill all the Indians, or try to kill all the Indians. Actually, the Indians fought them off, but that's another matter. But the point is, corporate schizophrenia is what's built into capitalism. The people who run it, who live in corporations and work every day in corporations, are your neighbors. They go to church with you. Their children play with your children and so on. But once they get inside that corporate structure, they have to follow certain rules or else they get kicked out. If they don't further growth as primary, and that's the only primary thing, they're out on the street like the rest of us. And so the amorality of the system is a thing that is not often talked about. People say, oh, well, capitalism can go green. Capitalism cannot go green unless it's very, very profitable, just as profitable as oil development. And finally, it doesn't make people happy. That's what Helena likes to talk about, and she's absolutely right. It doesn't make people happy. You know, the United States, which is supposed to be the vision of what the world should really be like, the greatest achieving economic society and so on. If you really look at the numbers on the United States, it has the highest divorce rate in the developed world. It's 41st. It's highest and one of the highest amongst suicide. It's 41st among 107 countries reported. It's the highest in terms of adult obesity. It's the highest in terms of infant maternal mortality. It's second highest in terms of infant mortality. It's second only to Mexico in terms of childhood poverty. It's highest in prison incarceration. It's second in murder rate. It's very high in rape and armed robbery and home ownership and so on. I could go through a long, long list that's in the book. And it doesn't even have a very big middle class. You know, middle class is what the United States is supposed to be, home ownership and middle class. Among industrial nations, the United States is like 15th or 16th in terms of middle class developed nation middle class and home ownership. And countries like Sweden, Norway, and Japan are way ahead. And look at voter turnout. The United States is one of the lowest voter turnouts. That's really a great expression in terms of how people feel about the system, that they don't even participate in it. They've sort of given up on it. And at the same time, they turn on their TV and they see all these happy people running around, and that's the image they're supposed to look up to. So all of these seven things, growth, amorality, hierarchy, control of consciousness, control of government, propensity to war, and it doesn't make us happy. Those are very important intrinsic ingredients of the capitalist system, and they need to be recognized and talked about, and we need to come up with systems that are the exact opposite of that.
You know, the basic things that we're trapped in, you know, it's like, or yeah. The things that allow certain people to benefit and others to be subjugated to their ability to benefit. So you have to pay rent. Right. You know, some people get money from rent. Some people get money from profit. Some people get money from interest. Some people get money from dividends. And of course, the myth is that we all either do that to some extent because, you know, maybe we have a bank account that has a little bit of interest, or we can someday be ourselves in the position, which I think is still one of the most, you know, defining myths that keep us in thrall in the American system.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That we can all be that. Well, yeah. They keep dangling that. You know, that's anybody can start a corporation and become General Motors eventually, or become Goldman Sachs or something like that. And they just dangle that out there, and that's just, the media has a very, very big role in all that, in the vision of competitive success that is actually not available to people. And except in very extraordinary circumstances, and in certain key moments, like for example, the sudden burst of technology now, which is creating new billionaires by the score. In the early days of the growth of that world, but that's not even going to last. And in any case, where is it leading us? We don't really know at all where that, you know, what the consequences of that are. And it's very, very, very important to eventually understand that, because we're going to find ourselves afloat in another kind of world. We already are, to a large degree, moved away from nature and away from our nature in ourselves and away from our own human consciousness and just becoming part of the machine. And that brings us more and more and more within the control of the people who control that system, of which there are a few very, very wealthy, powerful people. And we're just cogs in a different kind of system than we were before.
So we only have a couple of minutes left. Maybe talk about the what you're going to be talking about at the conference. We haven't talked much about that, the economics of happiness.
You know, I'm going to be talking as I'm talking to you now. I mean, these are the kind of subjects I talk about. I haven't yet written or thought through exactly what I'll say. This is a very broad program with speakers covering a lot of different dimensions. That altogether, you know, the sum will be greater than the sum of its parts, you know. So it's I'm not sure yet, but most likely I'm an economist by training, and I'll probably be talking about the effects of the system, the effects of the and the ingredients of the system. And one of the things I haven't talked about so far on this phone call, I'll talk a lot about the ingredients of change that are going to be needed from my point of view. From the point of view of systemic change, what's going to be required? In my view, there are really four major territories that we have to focus on in order to change our outlook and change the kinds of systems we're operating within. The first one is that in all economic activity, We're in the midst of a planet that is dying in front of our eyes. We will soon die with it, or many of us will. And in any case, catastrophic change is going to take place. And whatever new system we have, it has to start with nature. It has to start with protecting nature, that the values of preserving nature are primary. We can't forget about that. Nature comes first. And probably that also requires a smaller system, not based on growth, a system that is, no growth, and that is much smaller in scale. The way we put it in New York was not large scale, small scale, not global, local, not faster operating, slower, not more consumption, less, not top down, bottom up, control from the bottom, not private, shared. Not investor-owned, community-owned. Not more technology, less technology. Not meta-economics, microeconomics, local economics. Not competitive, collaborative. Not more trade, less trade. Not more energy, less energy. Not big business, small business. It's got to be rooted in local systems, and indigenous people have a whole lot to teach us about that. We have to restore nature. This is all primary because we have to put the planet back to where it's working. Now, people say, well, if you do nature comes first and you contract the system, how do you keep all the people alive? Well, we may have too many people, number one, but even without speaking about that, there's a concept called contraction and convergence, which I'm very interested in, which is that as the system gets smaller, we have to create a system where all the money doesn't go to the 1%. It's more equally shared and shared among all of us. So that's just the first discussion, the main among these main points. Nature is primary. Nature comes first.
if we take seriously the fact that it's actually the amplification effects of our technologies that are creating, that are driving the crisis, that it's all the machines that are burning so much energy, so much fossil fuels and pumping in the atmosphere, that's the real issue. And, you know, going back to the, you know, the maligned Luddites who, you know, had a craft technology and resisted the imposition of factory technology 200 years ago, you know, that they're seen as quaint and atavistic and anti-progress and whatever. But the reality is, if you have people, if a large number of people are doing the same thing that machines are doing, you reduce the impact on the earth, you increase the collaboration, you increase the ability of people to do things for themselves and not have the corporate overlords and masters dictating it. Ivan Illich talked about, you know, the watershed, you know, the how things...
Watershed economics.
How things shift once you get beyond a certain speed or beyond a certain, you know, institutional size. And that's where you get into really difficult conversation. You get into really nitty gritty. No, it's like, we cannot have these people running the show anymore.
You're absolutely right. Well, it's the economics of localism, and you're absolutely right. Every time we get a new labor-saving machine, it means it saves a lot of labor and puts a lot of people out of work, and creates greater problems than it ever solves. And bringing things back to the local community-oriented shared systems, collaborative systems. And also, if you don't have capitalism, you don't have to overproduce. You don't have to produce more than you need. You only have to produce what the community needs for itself and for its future. And that's why I read that little list of, you know, local, not global, local, not national. And all power has to come back down to the local. It's a term that is used a lot in our movement called subsidiarity, meaning that all power has to come down to the local level as much as possible, and all systems have to be based upon the needs of local systems, and rather than the needs of profit and creating extra wealth so that it can be shared with investors and can drive growth and so on. And that's all part of a third element, which is, you know, you have nature comes first, you have the primacy of scale, the importance of small scale, and a third one is direct democracy. You know, you need to have democracy which is not filtered through major layers of spending and media and so on, where people get together and they make decisions, and the indigenous people's models are very, 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 very valuable. I highly recommend people study the Iroquois model, for example, which is completely brilliant and was very, very successful until this other society came in and dominated them militarily and so on. And as far as corporations go in the future, if we really want something called a corporation, we can just change all of its ingredients completely. I have a list in my book of some 45 changes of corporations, you know, including publicly owned, not privately owned. Corporations shouldn't have the rights of people. Should be true cost accounting, so that if a corporation is doing something that affects nature, that's included in its accounting systems. It should have maximum size. It should not have limited liability. It should have site here to sell here policies and limits on salary ratios. You know, these new worker co-op or worker-owned corporations, you have the top-level executives making about twice what the people on the assembly lines are making. In corporations, the average corporate, you know, Fortune 500 corporation in this country, the top executive is making 500 or 600 times what the line workers are making. That's ridiculous. That's completely devastating to the future. And then as to what system you need to construct, it probably needs to be some kind of hybrid system. There may be certain things involved in our current system that are worth retaining. there may be certain things in socialism. I think central planning is probably a good idea. I don't see why that's bad, unless you get a terrible centralized government that makes all the rules, which we have now. As soon as you say something like that, somebody calls you a communist. I am not a communist. Let me just make that really clear. But I think that there is a hybrid system that can look at all other systems, including the hybrid systems of Scandinavia, which are very highly developed and very interesting, and some other countries as well, and see models that are in the process of being experimented with, and you know, come up with our own kind of community model. And we just have to break from what we have now and then really go through the process of defining and encouraging new systems.
That was Paul Rowland speaking with Jerry Mander, author of several books, including In the Absence of the Sacred, and most recently, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. He'll be speaking at the Economics of Happiness Conference coming next week, February 27th to March 1st, at the Elliott Center in downtown Portland. More information about the conference is available at our website, kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage, under Community Events, or at www.localfutures.org. This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:30 a.m., and coming up, we hear the organizers of next week's panel discussion on occupation, environmental destruction, and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not currently a KBOO member, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Theater. Starting February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Becoming Dr. Ruth tells the story of the outrageous and iconic Dr. Ruth Westheimer and the journey she took from fleeing the Nazis to her struggle as a single mother to coming to America and becoming a renowned sex therapist. Again, that's